Accession number 10691, Rule 3.
Mrs. Natton, Rule 3.
A limousine came and took Billy Wybrow away, and that was the last that we saw of Billy. With us, we remember the soldiers coming in, or the freedom people coming in, and we were put onto those awful trucks again, but this time for a different purpose, and we were flown back to Singapore. And from the airport, we were put onto more trucks, and we congregated outside of Raffles Hotel. My mother's relations, because she was one of a family of 12, very Dutch colonial, 9 boys and 3 girls. She didn't know what had happened to her relations, but my uncle Philip, now deceased, was there to meet me. He had been in Changi. So I apologise, he'd been in Changi, and he'd also been on the Burma Siam Railway. He was there somehow to meet us, and my mother was looking for all around the truck for my father. The sad thing was that my father had passed us and hadn't recognised us because we were so thin and almost indescribably dirty. And I said to Mum, "It's Daddy, it's Daddy." And she said, "No," but it was my father. And of course, then we went into Raffles, but they booked us in. And one of the first, of course, there were uncles or cousins, the Newman family, were there also to meet us. Because again, our circle was Hong Kong, India, Malaya as well. And they said to me, "What do you want to eat?" And I said, "Food." And they said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Apples." And no, I didn't say apples, a correction. I said coconut, banana and rice. And so I had a lovely feast of coconut, banana and rice. But we weren't at Raffles for very long. I can also remember being in this lovely place and having a bathtub all to myself, which is wonderful, and being cleansed. And my father standing away from the door and looking down at me as though wondering, is this my daughter? Is this my beautiful child? Or I was supposed to be beautiful a long time ago. And we were put on the... Later we were put on a ship and we were sent to England. And we were taken off at Liverpool. There were a lot of troops on board the ship, all being expatriated. My father was with us. And as soon as we came to Southampton, my mother was taken to Broadlands, where Lord Mountbatten had opened a special wing for the internees. And my mother was being fattened up and given special treatment. And she was also operated on for cancer, because by this time she was virtually a shell. And she was given Guinness in order to get her, in order for her to recuperate, which is quite nice, I suppose, if you like Guinness. And there's a lady next door, in one of the beds next door, started complaining about this woman being given special treatment. So apparently the nurse called this lady aside and said, "Look, this woman's been a prisoner of war." And of course, things subsided then. The animosity was just taken away. But I can remember the humility of our being taken down to the Shirley Baths in Southampton, being deloused and cleansed. And afterwards, the fact that you couldn't speak her own language is rather humiliating. The fact that suddenly that you were eating good food had peculiar repercussions on you, because you started developing sores through having been deprived of vitamins, and your body wasn't used to taking in good food, so you started breaking out in all sorts of rashes. So most embarrassing, having to go to school, being able to speak the English language, and also having all these bandages around you. And of course, it was explained to the teacher at the time that what had happened, but children, being children, didn't make fun of you. So you retreated into yourself rather, and they made fun of you because you were English, but you couldn't speak your own language. And that's when the teacher said, "Well, we don't want her speaking Dutch anymore. She's got to speak English." And because I had a translator and interpreter, I also had a very bad chest. I think everybody had a very bad chest. And I was sent down to the general in the South Ants for sundry treatment. I was in this country for perhaps 2 years, less than that. And my mother and father's marriage broke down because my father would never, ever, ever talk about the war. We didn't know what happened. He just refused. It was a closed book. He didn't want to talk about it at all. And the marriage just went on the rocks. So from being, I believe, a very kind man, he developed almost into some kind of a monster. He's, in fact, a relative of the Robin Eames, who was the Bishop of Northern Ireland. They look very much alike, actually. And they have carried on the family name, because my father was Frederick Robert Benn, B-E-N-N, and of course Robin Eames is also Robert Eames, and they look so much alike, it's fantastic. But he just would not talk about it at all. It was a closed book. I think perhaps if there had been counselling, well, this again is with hindsight and being adult now instead of a child, if there had been a bit of counselling, if there had been some money, because we didn't get any compensation for it, it would have been better, because my mother lost nearly all of her family, and those who remained in Kuala Lumpur didn't fare much better, because they were not far away from where they were in Kuala Lumpur. In one of the houses at the back, there was the torture house. And for two of my cousins who remained, they had to take pillows and just lump it onto the children's ears so the children wouldn't hear the screams of those who were being tortured. One of my aunts, Australian, Doris, she was being interrogated and tortured by the Japanese at the Lee Rubber Building in Singapore. And rather than be tortured, she just couldn't take it. She committed suicide. She jumped. Three of my uncles on the Burma Siam Railway. One was a Mr. Lawrence van der Straten, and he was decorated after the war. I've got pictures of him somewhere being decorated. But he died with all his medals because he said it wasn't worth it.
Now, obviously you were, as you said, just under 4 years old when Singapore fell.
That's right.
And so you were about seven at the time of liberation. So obviously people are going to wonder how reliable your account of all this is, since you were so young.
Yeah.
What are your own opinions about accuracy of what you've said?
100%. Because, one, I have a fantastic memory, fantastic recall. Even today I can recall things that since 1946 I haven't spoken Dutch. I can swear, God for Dam, God for Dolly, God for Dickum, who you want. I can sing Lance van der Leven, and I can, if people suddenly say something in Dutch, I might not understand the totality of it, but you click on immediately, and I wish to goodness that somebody at the time had been sensible and said, let her be not just bilingual, let her keep her Dutch, because to have just shushed it all out was rather cruel, I think, in the circumstances. Well, it would have been an asset. But singing the Dutch freedom song, all that stays very clearly in my mind.
But presumably, your memories are now really intertwined with your mother's memories.
Yes,
in a way,
because
in
mother,
what you've said.
Yes, mother has made it a point of keeping a lot of the things alive, because she has admitted that her memory is not 100%. So she has kept mine alive. But at many of those things, I was present. Of the occasions when I wasn't with my mother, I wouldn't know. You grew up so very, very quickly, you didn't have a childhood. And later you found it rather difficult to assimilate, because you were so independent, you were so wild and so shrewd and so cunning in many instances, that you missed a very valuable part of your childhood. And I found it very difficult to assimilate within the first school situation in Foundry Lane School in Southampton. And also the fact that I couldn't read and write, because of the breakdown of my mother's marriage. My mother decided, perhaps, and the lawyers decided, that her interest in mine would be best served if she went back to her family in Kuala Lumpur after the war, which where we went back there. We flew back there. And I went to St. Mary's Girls' School in Kuala Lumpur. And I spent a very happy 10 or 11 years there, but found it rather desperate. I felt I had to compete and prove myself, because I couldn't speak the language. When I went to school on the first day, Miss Pinnick, who was the headmistress, was going to put me in the kindergarten, because that was really all I was worthy of or capable of. But I said, no, I'm not going to go with those babies. I'm 8 years old now. And she was apparently quite rather impressed with my spirit, and she said, all right, we'll give her a try. And if you can catch up or learn the language quickly, well, I have my report card, and within 50 days, apparently, I was in the top five of the class in most things, except maths, and maths have always been a problem ever since. But where the command of the English language was concerned, I caught on very quickly. I assimilated very quickly. And it was wonderful because there were girls that I was going up with through the forms who had initially made fun of me because I could speak the language. And whilst, yes, my maths were absolutely atrocious, because maths is a peculiar subject, if you miss one rung of the ladder, then you have to go back right down and start all over again, because you can't really afford to miss any rungs. When it came to the written word, and when it came to poetry and to recitation and dictation, then I was at the top of the class. And it was a wonderful feeling walking down the aisle when you had to do dictation or do poetry, and your memory was absolutely fantastic, because you had this wonderful gift of being able to memorise things quickly. Helped in exams, I might add. And knowing that, all right, you had come here unprepared. You had come here in a very secondary situation, not knowing the language, because they were Chinese and Malay girls and Indian girls who speak the language wonderfully and who were very, very clever indeed. But that one situation, they couldn't touch you because you had mastered the situation. You could master every situation. And you tended also, in a very funny way, to keep yourself very much to yourself. But those 10 years or 11 years in St. Mary's were wonderful because it gave you almost a time to get back to sometimes being a child again. And that was very valuable. It was a breathing space which was most appreciated in the circumstances, because all right, mother had to go to work. I lived with my grandmother and, of course, the people who had survived. But they seemed to understand the situation. It was a brilliant church school, government-aided, where perhaps I was one of six Europeans. In the main, it was Chinese and Malay and Indian. But we didn't have any problems. We didn't have racial problems. We didn't have fights. We didn't have quarrels. You were so intent upon learning. Education was so vital because for many of them, it was a door to freedom and to bettering yourself, that whilst perhaps the six white girls took it for granted, I have photographs of my school as well, it was wonderful because you didn't have racial fights, you didn't have people taunting you, you accepted the fact that the Muslim, because it was a Muslim country, didn't take part in religious knowledge studies because they had their own religion, but the Chinese girls did. The Chinese girls and Indians are wonderful at maths, and the fact that you were living in a foreign country, you had access to so many different religions and to so many different cultures, that your mind was so hungry for knowledge, starved of knowledge. And mother was very wise, because she would not say, no, you mustn't mix with these and you mustn't mix with those, you mustn't go here, you mustn't go there, because she was of the opinion that, and still is, we are all God's children. And therefore, each religion has something good to offer. So I had a wonderful time. I used to go to the Buddhist temples and the Buddhist ceremonies. I used to go to the Hindu because they had their Deepavali, to the Malays. So it really was a wonderful experience. And I think perhaps this was an outcome of mother's experience in the camp, whereby she said, we're all one under the sun, and therefore go out and take the best of everything that you can get.
Has your experience in captivity, Japanese captivity, changed your own attitude towards life?
I hated, for a while, I could not stand the sound of marching boots. Even today, I detest martial music. Whether it's psychological or not, I don't know. I couldn't stand lorries. I hated lorries. It has, in a way, because I resent authority. My mother said one of the most peculiar things was watching this tiny person go around the camp looking for ways to get over the wall. And mother said to me, why are you doing this? Why do you go around? Because I used to pace the place all the time, wondering, how can I get out of here? How can I get to the other side? And mum used to take me and say, look, just for now, you can't go over. And I turned on one occasion rather vehemently to my mother and said, I will not ever, ever be told not to do this and not to do that again. And it hasn't made me... It hasn't helped my attitude towards authority, and I hate people putting me into a corner and saying, you can't do this and you can't do that. But I am now 50. I'm divorced. I've got a son who's a screenwriter and journalist. My ex-husband is Norwegian. And oddly enough, it's a funny story. My late father-in-law was involved in the Norwegian resistance. He was, in fact, helping British pilots and Jews escape via an escape route from through Denmark, and he was actually caught by the Germans and tortured very badly. He was Norwegian. So you see, it wasn't only the Japanese, it happened everywhere. We didn't know too much about the Holocaust because we had our own problems. Has it affected my attitude? It has made me, in a way, far more tolerant because there were so many acts of kindness that you do remember. And if not for those acts of kindness and the special timing, I wouldn't be here today. My mother has adopted the attitude, well, they've nearly killed us so many times, well, shoot us now, what the hell. But it wasn't only the people who were imprisoned or in concentration camps who suffered. The people who had to stay at bay, who couldn't get on the ships, they suffered just as badly, because apparently in Kuala Lumpur, in Ceylon, they had the telegraph posts, and those posts were lined with the decapitated with the heads of people who had who are not popular with the Japanese, shall we say. So it must have been horrendous for those who stayed back, who were in a similar, they were in a cat prison without bars. Ours had wood and wire, etc. We were all in prison. But I do not hate the Japanese. I dislike Hirohito because I think he could have helped a little. He was aware of the situation. But do I hate? No. Neither does my mother.